Hello and welcome to Joshua Space, a podcast all about books and pop culture. On today's episode, I have the wonderful privilege of talking with Anne Christie. She's a USA Today bestselling author. She's published 25 books. In fact, The Never-Ending End of the World is her 25th novel, not to mention the other anthologies and short story collections she's been a part of. Thank you so much, Anne, for joining today.
It's my pleasure.
So do you want to tell us what The Never-Ending End of the World is all about?
That's actually a tough question because, you know, you could say it's where physics goes wonky, what happens to the world, and you could say it's in a 40-year adventure to figure out the meaning of life. You could say a lot of things like that, survival. But to me, what it all comes down to is how you find people that you should hate and they become your family. And, you know, how working together and allowing yourself to trust and be with others who are not the same as you can change the world.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, because it is a very interesting novel in the sense of there's a lot of different directions that you could describe it, with it being almost a dystopian or almost like a post-apocalyptic, but the apocalypse never really ends. It's just kind of continuing and you're trying to navigate through it for several years. How did you first get the inspiration, or where did you get the inspiration from for the story?
Well, it's kind of a weird story, but my dad caught COVID very early in the pandemic, before they even knew COVID was in his area. And so he did volunteer work in old folks' homes for where, you know, less privileged. So he did volunteer work there and he, you know, caught it there. But because they didn't believe it was in that area, nobody even knew it was in the elder care community, they didn't believe him, didn't even test him. So by the time he got to the hospital, his kidneys were already dead. The COVID was almost gone, but his organs were all shutting down. So he was in the hospital for a really, really long time. And I couldn't touch him. I couldn't be with him. I could just leave my phone open and listen to his heart monitor. And that's all I could do. And so when I finally got the chance to hug him for the first time, on my way home, I voted in the election. And those two things sort of combined to get rid of that writer's block that I'd been having during the whole pandemic. And while I was brushing my teeth, I had this weird flash of a young woman in the middle of Manhattan, which is a city I love. She's in the middle of Manhattan wearing all these watches. And she's a kind of a mess. She totally needs a bath. And she says, whispers, "I've been whispering so long, I don't know what my voice sounds like." And I was like brushing my teeth. I turned off my toothbrush and I was like, "And who are you?" So by the time, and then I thought, well, that was weird. So I went to bed. But when I woke up the next morning, I had the whole novel in my head, the whole thing. And I got up and I was like, this is kind of cool. And NaNoWriMo had just started and I had writer's block, so I had no intention of playing. So I ran downstairs, and for the next 21 days, I sat at that computer the whole time and pounded out 120,000 words.
Oh my goodness.
That's how it came to me.
Wow. So when you started writing, did you do any, like, did you write out the plot points, or did you just start writing and just go right into the thick of it?
Well, I'm a plantser. I'm somebody who gets the inspiration immediately, like a pantser, and that incredible urge to write with the feelings. But I know that that's can be disorganized mess for me. So I have forced myself to learn how to plot in ways other than plotting, because plotting destroys all my joy. So I use Campfire. And so I basically have two monitors. So I have Campfire up on one and I have my Word on the other. And I start populating things with visual images, snips of music, people, places, while I write. And I know that sounds like a hot mess, but it works for me.
Yeah. And what works, works.
Yeah.
When you write, you're more of a visual thinker. Like, you want to see the photos and like see the different visual aspects of what you're writing about.
Yeah. I have a really good visual imagination, but I forget the details. So I have to find a way to store those details. So I have this enormous playlist and I'll go through and I'll look for songs that capture some scene. And that will allow me to re-enter my emotional state at that scene, which helps me keep the details. And then for Campfire, I'll like throw up an image and put a few words of my feelings across it. And, you know, to me, and only to me, does that mean a whole scene. So I am definitely visual, but I have to find a way to capture the details along with the feelings.
Yeah. Is that the fastest you've ever written a book before?
Yes.
Okay.
That was insane. You do not want to know what my house looked like at the end of that 21 days. Yeah.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, and my diet, I was probably suffering from malnutrition. I'm serious.
Are you a coffee drinker?
I am. Yeah.
So a lot of coffee during those 21 days, I'm sure.
Yeah, and chocolate. And the Instacart people, when they would show up with my bags full of snacks, because that's all I could do, they would like back away slowly from the door because I would be wearing these like mismatched clothes with, you know, a rat's nest on my head. I mean, it was a very bad month for hygiene.
That's awesome. Okay. So with the way it came to you and kind of just this, like, I don't want to say impulse, but like this, just like over the sensation that just kind of overtook you with the story and it all came to you. Is that usually where you draw inspiration from with your other novels, where you get snippets of different things like that? Or it's...
Well, I think like a lot of pantsers, a natural pantser is, I think that what happens is we get, you know, inspired by a beginning, we get inspired by an ending, and then all the work is really for us in that hump between connecting them. You know, the inspirations are great. They strike a lot. It's the work of the middle that's harder for us. And so I would have to say, yes, I do get inspirations like that, but never like what happened with this one. I think that was my brain sort of unlocking after going through all that I went through, because while my dad was sick, I was also out in the world with people who would like there was one, I'll give you a quick story. I was in a grocery store and there was a guy came in without a mask and they told him, you know, he was going to have to go, and he was screaming and yelling about his rights and that if he wanted to catch COVID, it was his right to get COVID. And the man said, the mask isn't for you. The mask is so that you don't give it to other people. And he goes, if they die, it's not my problem. And I was standing there with, and my dad was critical at that point. You know, we had had that last phone call, and I was standing there with my hands on the cart, and I realized that that noise I was hearing was the cart banging up and down because I was shaking so hard, and that I was a danger to myself and to others at that point. So I left. And I think that what this inspiration was, all of that unlocking, because I got to see my father at home and safe, and if not whole, alive, yeah. You know? And I think it just unlocked. So that was a very different situation. And I don't know if it'll ever happen again. This might be a one-off.
Yeah, that's a lot of extenuating circumstances to create just that one thing that just unlocks it all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think our brains are just miracles that way. And this is what came out of it.
So total side note, now is your dad doing okay?
Oh yeah. Well, he's on a transplant list. So he got all of his organs working again except his kidneys. COVID is a beast. I mean, there's no way to guess which one you're going to be. You cannot gamble with it in any way. So, I mean, and I know every writer's got their COVID story, right? But I think in this book, you can kind of see, and again, we're off topic, but I think in this book, you can kind of see where I was trying to marry the idea that people who thought differently could somehow coexist.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that's my black box of a brain working out these things without my knowledge. You know what I mean? All deep down inside. And I think this just exploded it. I mean, it just...
And I think it's done really well because it really shows that even if someone has a completely opposite mindset of something, you can, there's still humanity. So there's still levels of, we're all humans and we all fundamentally have the same necessities to live or certain truths. And I think that was kind of shown throughout the book with the two different groups in the novel, with they both had the same look on things, but in a completely different way to get to the same end goal. And I think that was it very much mirrors COVID and everything that happened with the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah, it does in a way. I mean, it's kind of weird, but most readers won't notice that. They'll just feel some sense of kinship, but not really marry up the idea that is also COVID.
Yeah. When I think
it, which is good.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say is I think it's one of those where you weren't writing it for the reason of explaining the pandemic. You were writing it as this own story. And the fact that it correlates is just coincidental in a sense. It's us putting ourselves into the story as well and translating it. Because if 50 years from now, someone who reads this book might be relating it to two types of people in that time, and it has nothing to do with the pandemic. So it really has to do with our own surroundings and our own experiences.
Yeah, it's all about us and them. And there is always an us and them.
Was there a really difficult scene that you had when you were writing where it got like you just, it was hard to write that scene?
The ending. I mean,
Yeah.
there is a reason that people snot cry when they read that ending. I was snot crying the entire time. There were days of just mountains of Kleenex. And well, also the back of my shirt, the sleeve of my shirt. Because I really wanted that ending to be something that I can't say it without spoilers, right? But
No.
I for the reader, I wanted it to be one way, but I knew it had to be the way it was.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like I was forcing myself to do this extremely painful thing, like, run a knife up and down my arm. It was so painful and difficult. And I cried the entire time. I was apologizing to the characters as I was writing it. I really was.
I believe it because that ending, when I was on the last chapter, I mean, I couldn't stop reading, but when I was reading the last chapter, my mother walked by and I was in my bedroom and I am just sobbing at this point. And she's like, "What's wrong?" And I'm like, "I'm reading a book. Go away. Like, just go away." Like, I cannot talk. Because
Oh.
it is very emotional. It is the perfect ending. I think it's, as much as I wish it would have gone a different route, I think it wouldn't have done the book and the story justice for
Right.
the way it, you ended up ending it. And it was just a beautiful but heart-wrenching ending.
Oh, is it terrible if I say it makes me really happy that you cried like that?
I don't think so. I think it's it means it made a connection, but it was I was sobbing a lot.
Yeah, well, you're not alone. I was sobbing too. I mean, the CMO of the company that, is publishing it was sobbing. So I think it's kind of one of those things. It's like an onion in the form of a book. You open it, you're gonna cry.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to ask, and we've already kind of gone over it, and I think I already know the answer for the most part, was I know on your website you talk about having writer's block during pandemic, and deducing that is it mainly because of what you were going through with your dad that you weren't able to write, or did it start before that?
It actually started before that. I used to publish a lot more frequently. I mean, I had two editors lined up all the time. And I was kind of a workaholic because of, my military career. I mean, if you want to succeed, you've kind of got to be a workaholic. And so I kept this extremely rigid schedule. And I realized that if I just stopped doing that and I slowed down and I started thinking more about the art of it, that I would make better books. So I purposefully slowed down and I worked really hard not to not be a workaholic anymore. But one of the things that came from that is that I was sort of adrift and writer's block kind of crept up a little bit. Because what if there's one thing a really rigid schedule will provide you, and that's motivation. Because otherwise you're going to sit there staring at the computer for 9 hours, and nobody wants to do that. So writer's block had sort of been creeping up on me for a while. But what was the nail in the coffin was that I had finished this series called Strikers that took me 5 years to do. And it's post-apocalyptic. The story begins 100 or just over 100 years after a massive thing, which turns out to be germ related. And to celebrate the last book coming out, I wrote this thing called First Strike, which is a novella that's the prequel, which ha is how the pandemic happened, which was actually an attack. And I published that right before the pandemic began, like right before. And the way it's laid out and the things the people go through and all of that, it was like bad timing, really bad timing. So when your world starts to look a lot like your fiction, it becomes very difficult to write the fiction.
Yeah.
And that was really the nail in my coffin. And then what my dad's situation, of course, just.
Yeah, it prolonged it. But that's looking back now to read that novella or to read just any book that talks about a pandemic. It's a lot sometimes.
Yeah. And especially when I laid it out, because I actually did all, I researched this series really deeply. Like I actually made that trek, this huge trek that they went through. And I researched it very deeply, including developing ways to actually distribute a weapon of mass destruction in a way that was effective. And of course, you know, yeah, that was a very bad choice on my part.
But there's no way to know that. That's the thing with the world we live in. There's no way to know what's going to happen tomorrow.
No, there really, really isn't. It was just really bad timing.
Okay, so jumping slightly back to the never-ending end of the world, the ending was very powerful. Do you have any plans to continue the story in any facet? Or is it standalone, done, moving on to the next project?
Well, I have this policy, and a lot of people don't know about it, but I have this policy that any world that I can make open, I will. Meaning that all an author has to do is tell me what they want, and if it matches the canon, they can write in any of my worlds, keep all their own money. All that, you know, they have to write in the book that it's based on this world, but other than that, that's it. And I talked to the publisher about making this open world, and they said yes, no strings attached. Okay. So what I want to see is people writing other things in this world. I have written another story called Endless Honeymoon, which you'll be available to get it. It's for anybody who reads the book. They can, you know, click and get it. And then two other people have actually written in that world already. There are three stories out. And I just went through a Discord last night with another writer who laid out an amazing tale. And and that one's going to get the open world contract as well. So what I actually want is for other people to write in that world and let me read it. I want to be the reader.
That's awesome.
And I hope they make a bajillion dollars.
But well, honestly, if this book does not go far, then I don't know what is happening with the publishing world, because it deserves that very much. Of course, I read a lot of books. And I read a lot of science fiction books. It's kind of like, that's my go-to genre. And I like to go into books kind of blind. And so I, like, when I go into a book, I don't really expect a whole lot just because I don't know what it's going to be about. I go in very blind. And so with this book, the whole time I was like, oh my God, like the entire time, like, this is so good. So it was one of those where it was like the whole time, like, this is incredible. And then it was like, well, it's not coming out for a few months. I can't talk to anybody about this yet. So now that it's out, I'm very excited to see like more people reading the book, because I can scream about it with other people. So
definitely. I mean, that's my biggest flaw is marketing. I am not good at self-promotion. And so anybody who shares out there is basically helping me avoid having to deal with a phobia. And I appreciate that.
I know we're jumping around quite a bit throughout the conversation, but jumping towards like the beginning of your career, because you talked about like with marketing. So when you first started with your career, how did you go about, like, where did you go traditionally? Did you go indie? How about did you go and get published?
I started on a dare. And that is actually what happened. So I was a military officer. Actually, I was a commander in the Navy. And I read this very obscure little novella called Wool. And it was just a little tiny novella, turned out to be one-fifth of a story, long time ago. And I read it and I was like, this is very cool. And this was written by an indie author. I'm into this. So a kind of group of us sort of coalesced around the idea of this indie author thing. And I very avidly followed Wool. But eventually I got really, really irritated. I was like, why does everybody who is cool die? And eventually I got up the nerve to write to Hugh Howey and, you know, kind of say, I'd like to try this. And he gave me Silo 49 and said, write your own, and just gave it to me. And then I was like, oh my gosh, now I have a silo and I'm not a writer, I'm a physicist. So my other friends, you know, in the writing community or whatnot, they're like, you can do it. You can do it. You know, you make up stories like that stuff all the time on the ship for to keep your watchers awake. You can do this. And, you know, it's like, I double dog dare you. And I was like, oh God, now I have to. So that is how it that's how it all came about. And so as soon as I published, I self-published because that's what Hugh Howey was saying to do. So of course I did what he said, you know, I self-published. And because it was attached to Wool and that, and Wool had become super famous by the time I published, I had a ready-made audience. And so I didn't even know about marketing. I'll give you a hint. I did not know how to check to see if I had sold books.
Wow. Okay.
So I did not understand rank. After about 8 months, the book is out. I noticed that my rank slipped down below like a few thousand. And I was so depressed. And I thought, oh, this is terrible. I'm sinking into obscurity. And they're like, are you seriously now? Your book is, you sold 100,000 copies and you think you're obscure. So when I say I came into this ignorant, that is not, I'm not exaggerating. I didn't know what the heck I was doing, but I learned fast. And I realized I loved it.
That's awesome. So for anyone listening that is an inspiring author, specifically indie or traditional, do you have any words of wisdom of things they should or should not do?
Well, first of all, learn how KDP works so you can find out if you sold books. I mean, come on.
Don't just release off the rank.
Yeah. Yeah, and get some realistic ideas about what's going on out there. 1,000 is good. So, actually, I don't like how people hoard information, so I am putting out a whole bunch of articles on Campfire. They're totally free and they're like open kimono, exactly how to do it. I really dislike that everybody is selling information that should be obvious. Yeah. So, I'm putting all those articles out that just spell it out. And doing a bunch of TikToks that spell them out step by step by step. And I'm always open for questions. But my advice is, you know, you are not an editor. That is my number one. And number two is think about what you actually want and who you actually are before you pigeonhole yourself. And because you don't have to be one thing in your life. You can be anything. And if today that's an indie writer, tomorrow it might be your own publishing house. And the next day it might be selling a one-off to a traditional publisher. You know, you can be anything you want. So don't feel like this is an irrevocable decision, because it's not.
Yeah. Life is a journey and you never know the direction it's going
to
go.
Right. And you got to be willing to go off the path a little bit sometimes to have fun.
Yeah. Sometimes if the door is barely open a crack, you need to just push it open.
That's right. Well, I have a few mottos in life. And one of my favorite ones is, stop worrying about what you look like and eat with the big spoon. And basically all that means is, you know, forget the stuff that doesn't matter. Just go for life in general. What makes you happy right now? Do it. Don't be afraid. Yeah. I think a lot of indie authors and aspiring authors out there that, you know, they can't quite get that project done. They can't quite bring themselves to publish. I think a lot of it is just fear. And we're missing out on some really great reads because of fear. So don't be afraid.
That's awesome. And I completely agree. I think sometimes it's the fear of unknown or the fear of failure that prevents a lot of people from going for it and holds them back when they could be going way farther than they think they could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, what are your top five favorite books of all time?
You know, this is actually a really hard question, because what you asked me is my favorite might not be my favorite next year. But there are a couple of ones that are totally consistent. American Gods, the 10th anniversary edition by Neil Gaiman. I mean, of course, it's the prose. You can weep over the prose. It's just so good. The second one would be Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. it's book two in a trilogy, the Mad Atom trilogy. And I like all three, but there is something very special about Year of the Flood. For a quirky selection, it's Bad Monkeys by Matt Ruff. Have you ever heard of that book?
I have not.
It's probably out of print by now. It's my first really fun experience with a possible unreliable narrator. You're never sure. And I love the idea of the unreliable narrator that seems reliable, or the reliable narrator, or the seemingly reliable narrator that turns out to be unreliable. It's very hard to get that right. And Bad Monkeys is one such. For my, I don't even know how to even describe my love for this book. Game of Thrones, the original first book in that entire series, because I'd never read anything like it. It was so filthy and wrong and vile and descriptive. And it made me hungry every time they ate some food, because he described food so wonderfully. So I think, you know, that one lines up there, because I just never read anything at all like it. And then my newest favorite out of that is Appleseed. Have you read Appleseed yet?
I have not, no.
Oh my God, you have got to read Appleseed. Okay, it's written by Matt Bell, and it is, I mean, obviously the title is kind of self-explanatory, but it takes it to a whole new level. Beautiful, beautiful book.
Okay. I am adding that right now. That was only published a couple of years ago too.
Yeah, that's my new selection.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I just added that one and the Bad Monkeys to my to be read, or TBB, my to be bought shelf.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I don't even know if Bad Monkeys is in, you know, print anymore, but it's kind of a weird book, but it was my first experience of that. So it kind of earns this special place, you know?
Yeah.
And, but there are some other books I've read recently that I'm like, how have I lived my life without these books? Like Hench. Have you read Hench yet?
No, I feel like I'm not a reader. No, I haven't.
OMG. It's by Natalie Walshots. Okay. And yes. And have you read The Book of Coley by M.R. Carey?
No.
Oh, dude. Okay. Come on now.
I have not heard of these books. I feel like not a book reader at the moment.
Well, I'm one of those people who when I buy a Kindle book, I'll often impulsively click if they have the WhisperSync edition, you know, where you can get the audio book for a discount. So and a lot of times I'll actually decide to buy a book based upon whether or not I can get a cheap audio book. I know it's terrible, but in both of those cases, I was reading the book and I was like, oh my God, I've got to listen to the audiobook. So then I switched to audiobook, and it was sort of like I was paralyzed for the next 20 hours, you know, just staring into space, listening to an audiobook. And so it could, a lot of my love may have to do with how well they were acted, you know, in the audiobooks, but man, they're totally original out there.
I will have to get that. I'm very much an audiobook person. And so yes. So I will definitely do the audiobooks. To your comment about trying to get cheap audiobooks, my go-to is there's locally, the public library system has, what is it? Libby is one of them. And so
yes.
Has the free audiobooks and ebooks, but I found out that there is where I live, there is the main library system for the county, and that uses Libby. And then there's other libraries in the area, and they use Cloud Library, which is the same thing as Libby, but a different app. And so I have both of them, of course. And so if it's not on one, I check the other one. I'm like, well, maybe it's over here. So
I do the same. I have Libby and Hoopla. Don't forget about Hoopla. And I think Hench and The Book of Coley are both on Libby. I mean, I think, yeah, Hench and The Book of Coley, I think they were both on Libby for my library system, which means they're somewhere in the library system. So you might give those a try. They were really good.
Okay, I will definitely check them out. I just added a lot of books to my TBR.
Sorry.
Exactly. That's most book people, I think. We just keep adding more books until we drowned in them. And then it's fine, because eventually we'll read them all.
Yeah. Although I have noticed that the more books I have in my TBR pile, the more likely I am to give a DNF. Because it's like, I have got 100 books sitting here that I would like to get through by the end of the year. And if I can't be captured in the first 100 pages, you know, I stop.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually had to add a new tag to my Libby shelves, and it was called problematic. And it was books where there were things that just, they were just too problematic for me to continue. Yeah. And it did, you know, it's a wide variety of reasons. It doesn't have to be anything in particular, but I have a problematic shelf now.
Yeah. Well, and it helps having those, because then you can go back, and if you're, oh, this book looks interesting. Oh, it's already on that shelf. I'm good.
Yeah.
So awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining on today's episode and chatting about The Never Ending End of the World. And huge happy release, because I know it came out this week. So happy release week.
Thank you. Thank you. And I was looking forward to this. This is my first podcast.
Is it really?
It is.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much again for joining. And thank you to everyone who listened to this episode. I hope you thoroughly enjoyed it. And I hope that you go pick up The Never Ending End of the World by Anne Christie, because it is seriously one of my favorite books of this year, if not the number one book I have read. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. And in case you need a little more encouragement, this coming Monday, I'll be interviewing Angie Thomas. Have a wonderful day and happy reading.